Men, with me. Tait and his handful of men ran behind Kilbert, down the curved roadway that led back into the town. Below him he saw the militia and garrison troops, who had survived the blizzard of arrows turning in retreat and jamming the narrow streets. Their force was spent, and they would either return to their homes and lick their wounds, or try and escape into the nearby village, knowing the town walls were bereft of bowmen.
"Sir Gilbert, do we burn these bastards out?"
shouted Tait. "In good time. First we make sure they never strike at us again. We'll see if anyone holds the town square and gates." The roadway slope pooled at Kilbert's leg muscles. He was tired. With good reason, he told himself. But the first stinging drops of rain against his face freshened him. He and the few men with him had the advantage that no retreating militia had yet reached any of the side alleys that would bring them onto the roadway. Those men in full retreat were now fighting for their lives, as Blackstone's men hacked at their backs. It didn't take long for Kilbert to reach the town square. The gates were closed, and the walls were still unmanned. He suddenly realized that if enough retreating men flooded the area where the gibbets stood, then he and Tate's men would soon be overwhelmed. It would be better to kill those they could and let the others escape into the night. "Open the gates," he ordered. The hard rain stung their eyes as they lifted the crossbeam free from the gates. They dragged open the heavy studded doors, which soon became a moor into the blackness of the countryside, and the muted shapes of the village obscured by darkness and rain. They heard the cries of approaching men funneling down through the streets. It felt as if the Almighty had finally thrown his displeasure against the murderous town, as thunder rolled across the mountains, and the clap shook the ground they stood on. Kilbert and Tait and his men formed a line, and as the first desperate survivors spilled into the yard, they struck at them and caused more chaos. The survivors, blinded by the rain, saw these men, and in their panic they could not know they were the only ones who faced them. The rain finally drenched the braziers, and those who could ran for the open gate. 30 men ran past Moulin's swordsmen, who struck from the side streets and soon fell dead in the mud. Moulin and Renfred appeared from one side as John Jacob and others came from another. Men still ran from them, and Kilbert was content to let them disappear into the storm beyond the walls. Exhaustion was already claiming Blackstone's fighters, as the lack of sleep and the action in the past 2 days drained them. When Moulin came into the yard by the gates, Kilbert sheathed his sword.
"It's done," he said. "Close the gates."
Moulin grinned, raised his sword arm and let out a roar. The victorious men with him bellowed into the slashing rain.
"Is Sir Thomas not with you?"
asked the Norman fighter. Kilbert squinted into the rain and looked around at the soaked men. Only a couple of the braziers still flickered, protected from the wind by the town walls. But he could see that Blackstone was not among them.
"John?"
he asked Blackstone's squire.
"He followed Moulin."
"I didn't see him," said the throat cutter.
"Is he wounded? Did he fall?" asked Kilbert, anxiously. A fleeting memory stung him. When he and Perrine had stood watch that night at the monastery, Perrine had told him of his fears for Blackstone, of the raptor's keening, of its first rising into the sky above Blackstone, how it had dogged their journey. Kilbert had spat and scoffed at Perrine's superstition. Theirs was a life ruled by the cruel bitch Fate. But the confined spaces of the narrow streets and the melee of the fighting meant it would be easy not to have noticed a man go down. It had been suffocatingly close during the hard-pressed killing. Kilbert shrugged the tiredness from his aching body.
"We must find him," he said,
and led the way back into the town streets. Chapter 50 As Blackstone had fought in the courtyard, he had seen 3 men break away once the archers had done their killing. They had squirmed their way through the crowd at a crouch, but Blackstone had recognized William Cade. Blackstone skirted the edge of the butcher's yard, using his shield and wolf's sword to cleave past 3 or 4 desperate and fear-fueled men who tried to stop him. He could see Moulin pressing home the attack yard by yard, and John Jacob forcing his way along the opposite flank. Blackstone suddenly found himself in an alley, where the rank smell of sweat mingled with that of blood and excrement. Eviscerated men rolled in agony in the dark as their comrades trampled their spilled intestines. Here and there, windows were opened in the houses, as women prepared to tip boiling water onto their enemy, stopping only when they saw that it was their own menfolk who fled in panic, screaming from their wounds. Light spilling from the shutters, in a brief respite from the darkness, allowed Blackstone to see where Cade was running. It looked as though he was heading towards the stables. But was it to hamstring Blackstone's horses, or an attempt to escape? One of the garrison troops blocked Blackstone's way. The man had strength enough to force him back a pace, and he fell over a dead body behind him. He smothered himself with his shield as the man hacked down. In the quickness of a breath, Blackstone dropped his guard and lowered the shield, looking at the dark shape that was trying to kill him. His deliberate attempt to draw the man in succeeded. His assailant boldly stepped forward, ready to strike the fatal blow. It allowed Blackstone to hook his boot behind the man's leg and tumble him backwards. Blackstone quickly recovered and lunged Wolf's sword down into the man's chest. Women were screaming from the open windows, which still gave sufficient light as he searched desperately ahead, but there was now no sign of Cade. Blood trickled down his face from an earlier blow, and it began to blur his vision in one eye. He lifted his face to the stinging rain and let it wash the blood away. He had turned his back on the street cluttered with bodies and panic, and shouldered his way down a passage. He tried to remember the street's layout from when he had walked them, checking his men's defences, but the darkness of the running battle had disorientated him. And then, more by chance than anything else, he caught the pungent smell of the stables on the wind. As he edged around the building, he could hear the unsettled horses shifting in their stalls. A flicker of an oil lamp passed across a half-open door. Blackstone bent down and groped in the dirt for mud at the base of the building. It was malleable in his fingers, not yet soaked by the rain. He pressed it into the cut on his forehead to stem the blood, and then crept closer to the opening. Three men were saddling horses in the dim light. One horse shied as Cade tightened the girth strap. He cursed and punched the horse, then kneed it in the belly, and wrenched the cinch another two notches tighter. Blackstone caught snatches of conversation above the driving rain. The men would ride into the square, and then Cade's men would open the gates. As Blackstone got closer, he sensed there was dissent from the men, but Cade raised his voice, and Blackstone heard the words King and Reward. As rolling thunder broke across the town roofs, one of the horses reared. Blackstone took the half-dozen strides into the stable and killed its rider, whose arms were raised, sawing at the horse's reins. Blackstone stepped quickly between the panicked beast, which slammed itself against the stall, and the second man who desperately tried to draw his sword as his horse turned and pushed him almost into Blackstone's arms. Blackstone head-butted him, his nose split, head whipping back before he could utter a cry. As the man went down beneath the horse's hooves, Blackstone sensed the rapid shadow that came between him and the oil lamp on the wall. He ducked, avoiding the knife strike from Cade, and rolled beneath the panicked horse, using his shield to protect him from the thrashing iron-shod hooves. The head-butted man grappled with him, spitting curses through his bloodied nose. For a moment it seemed that Blackstone could not break free, trapped as he was beneath his shield and the man alongside. Then one of the hooves caught the man's head. Blackstone heard the bones in his face crack. He pushed himself clear of the horse as Cade tried to get around the agitated beast. The horse was now between Cade and Blackstone, who threw his weight against the horse's rump in an attempt to reach the killer. In the confines between wall and stall, and with the wild-eyed horse dangerously shifting its weight, Blackstone's shield became a hindrance. He slipped it from his arm and threw his weight against the horse again, forcing it aside. He flung his shield at Cade, who fell back but recovered quickly, as one of the remaining horses whinnied and bolted into the storm. Cade slashed a high guard strike down onto Blackstone's blade. Blackstone parried it, half-turning, ready to let the momentum of his body cut across Cade's exposed chest. But no sooner had one horse made its bid for freedom than the others followed, knocking Blackstone off his feet. His head smashed into the stall's wall. Instinctively, he rolled clear, as wood splintered from Cade's sword thrust where a moment before his head had been. Cade's strike had all his strength behind it, and his blade sank into the soft old timbers. He tried to yank it free, but was forced to abandon it. Blackstone was on his feet as Cade ran for the door. Cade snatched a baling fork, turned, and jabbed the double tines at Blackstone. One of the narrow points pierced his mail and drew blood, high on his arm next to his shoulder. Had he kept his shield, the iron tip would have jammed into it, but now the strike made him half turn his shoulder away from the next thrust. The rain thundered down on the slate roof, Horses whinnied, crushing their weight against the walls of their stalls. The flickering oil lamp's dull orange glow threw a muted veil of light across the two men, who crouched, facing each other, like ancient gladiators, one with a long-handled spiked fork, the other batting away its jabs with his sword. If Cade caught Blackstone's sword between the two times, he could twist it away and gain the advantage. As Blackstone jabbed again, he deliberately threw his free arm forward, ramming it between the two tines. His strength forced the haft to twist in Cade's hands. Cade snarled as Blackstone wrenched the baling fork out of his hands. But he had the agility to avoid Blackstone's strike, which would have taken him across the shoulder and cleaved him to his hip. As Blackstone regained his balance and shook his arm free from the pronged fork, Cade snatched a sword from one of the fallen men and then backed away further towards the door. Neither man spoke, cursed or threatened. Each had his eyes locked on the other. Cade knew he had a chance to kill Blackstone. The bigger man was quick on his feet, but the half-light and confines of the stable gave the lighter man the advantage. He could duck and weave, and if he could deliver a maiming blow, the legend that was Thomas Blackstone could be ended. Cade's eyes widened with confidence. Blackstone's left shoulder had dropped. The stab wound must have gone deeper into his packed muscle than Cade had at first thought. But Blackstone showed no sign of pain, and he strode forward again as Cade pulled a length of chain from a wall hook and swung it. Blackstone winced as the links struck his wounded shoulder. He faltered. Cade grinned. He swirled the chain again, and this time entangled Blackstone's sword arm, snaring the crossguard. Blackstone was defenceless. His left arm drooped. His right was snagged. With a cry of triumph and a darting stride forward, Cade lunged. He was on his toes, limited in his movement by the taut chain on Blackstone's sword arm. And then the chain tightened further and pulled him off balance. He stumbled forward, his sword point dipping off target, and before his leg muscles could correct his fall, Blackstone's left arm swung forward and gripped his throat. Blackstone had fooled him. Stiff with shock, he choked. Blackstone held him in a crushing grip. Then, as his sword dropped, his hands grasped Blackstone's wrist in a vain attempt to relieve the pressure, and he saw Blackstone easily shake free the chain. His efforts to disable Blackstone had been useless. He was the one who had been duped and drawn in. Eyes bulging, spittle running from his lips, he gurgled as his breath was closed off from his lungs. His legs fought and kicked, but made no impression on the tall man holding him. Blackstone brought the suffocating man's face closer to his own.
"I promised you a slow death," said Blackstone, and threw him to the ground.
Gasping with relief and barely conscious, Cade fought for his breath. Through bloodshot, watering eyes, he saw Blackstone stand over him. A trickle of blood ran down the Englishman's scarred face, and for a moment in the flickering glow of light, he appeared to Cade's fear-struck mind as the devil's disciple.
"Where is the Welshman?" said Blackstone.
Through the depth of his pain and knowledge of certain death, Cade knew he could have one last victory over the English knight. He shook his head and rasped,
"You'll never know."
His breath wheezed in a pitiful laugh. Blackstone swung the chain across the roof beam. He secured it and tested its strength.
"It will take a long time to die, William Cade, and then I'll put your head on a pole outside the gates. Tell me where he went."
Cade had no fight left in him.
"When I die, you whore son, the Dauphin will know of it, and he will know where you are."
Cade wheezed again.
"It's over, you bastard. Even you cannot fight an army."
So the French had always intended to try and kill him, Blackstone realized, and the army that searched for Routiers also searched for him. By now, Chandos would have been at court, and the king and his son would know where Blackstone had been seizing the towns for Edward. It would not take long for messengers to reach the army, and for them to hunt him down. Chandos would not be able to help him now that Blackstone and his men operated alone. Blackstone dragged a bale of straw beneath the chain. He reached down and hauled Cade to his feet. Cade made a feeble attempt to struggle, but Blackstone easily had the measure of him, and banged his head with a short, sharp knock against the stall wall. It was enough to make the man cease. Blackstone twisted the chain round his neck and lifted him onto the teetering, uneven bale. Cade had no choice but to reach up and grab the chain above his head. But when Blackstone's sword tip sliced through the binding string, the bale collapsed. Cade kicked and wriggled, but he was unable to support his body weight with his hands on the slippery chain. Blackstone stood back and wiped away the blood from his eye. "You hanged young Peter Garland," said Blackstone. "Now Satan and his imps wait for you in the darkness." He sat tiredly on another bale, leaning against the wall. He pulled off his helm and eased back the coif beneath it. Sweat and blood caked his beard, but he did not mind the discomfort from the stinging wound. He had known far worse. He tilted his head slightly, so that the blood did not obscure the sight of Cade, slowly choking to death. Chapter 51 Blackstone and his men soon came together. He gathered the captains in the drenching rain. Some of the men, like Blackstone himself, had minor wounds that could soon be attended to.
"How many did we lose?" he asked.
"Seven dead," said Moulin.
Blackstone nodded wearily.
"All right.
The gates are barred, and the town dead clutter the streets. It's time the men got some sleep. Take everyone into the chateau. Use the lower rooms and light the fires. See what you can find in the kitchen, and dry out the men's clothing. There will be no more fighting here. The storm will see to that, and tomorrow the townspeople can clear away their dead." The captains gathered their exhausted men and made their way back to the chateau, where they barred the doors. Once the fires were lit, men quickly fell asleep, even ignoring the prospect of scavenging for food. Blackstone and Kilbert trudged upstairs to the Countess's rooms with John Jacob.
"You didn't kill her," said Blackstone.
"I struck her hard enough to stop her gelding me with a dagger."
"She will never stop hating us or men like us." "I can understand that," Blackstone said.
"She kills and tortures for pleasure, Thomas. A she-wolf, if ever there was one."
Their footsteps scuffed and echoed up the stone stairs.
"I've known a woman take up arms in revenge for the death of her family. Blanche de Harcourt raised a mercenary army when I failed to save her husband back in 56. She was a formidable woman, Gilbert. I can see some of her strength in this Countess Catherine. She holds her dead husband's fiefdom and survives as best she can."
"Aye, well, feel sympathy if you must, Thomas. But you did not come whisker close to having a knife plunged through your head after a night's passion."
"Perhaps she was left with no choice when you didn't succumb in her arms," said Blackstone, ignoring Kilbert's scowl as they walked through the Countess's room to her bedchamber.
The Countess was conscious, but remained tied up, as Kilbert had left her, still naked and shivering, as the fire in the room had died down to embers. Her hair was in disarray, and the bruise from Kilbert's blow discolored her cheekbone. Kilbert stepped forward and hauled her to her feet. After the fighting, he and Blackstone looked even more threatening than when they first arrived at Felice, and she made a slight protest of resistance, but he held her firmly and then draped a robe around her. He chastised her quietly, as if she were a child.
"Did you think I spent those hours with you only to offer myself up as a sacrifice?"
He tenderly eased a strand of hair from her face and kissed her forehead.
"Your hatred has poisoned your heart. We would have left you in peace, but now your soldiers and militia are dead. So too is William Cade. And now your men will rape and plunder," she said sullenly. "You have already lain with me, so whose turn is it next?"
"None of that will happen," said Blackstone. "The weather has turned against us, so we will stay a few more days. The citizens of Felice can bury their dead, and you will stay here in your rooms. Your bailiff and ladies can attend you."
He turned to John Jacob. "Build up the fire, John, then we'll drag these bodies onto the landing outside the rooms." Blackstone stepped closer to Kilbert and the Countess. "Your servants can be summoned to wash away the blood from the floor. Shall I fetch the apothecary to treat the bruising on your face?"
"I want to address my people, and for them to see that even I could not escape your brutality."
"And have you claimed I raped you?" said Kilbert.
"No, my lady. You will stay here in these rooms until we leave Felice."
The fire crackled in the hearth, and the flames quickly flared. Kilbert stayed with Countess Catherine as John Jacob and Blackstone bent to the task of dragging the first of the guards' bodies through the rooms and onto the landing, leaving a track of blood soiling the floor.
"I will send your servants at first light and have them bring hot water for you to bathe. and fresh reeds for the floor, said Kilbert, as the second body was heaved away. He undid the bindings on her wrists and ankles. You see, Countess, you tried to kill the wrong man. Thomas Blackstone is in command here. I simply misled you into thinking I was, so that I might take you to my bed believing you were the one who would protect me, believing I was the man you were going to kill, said Kilbert. We both played our parts. She turned her face away. Kilbert picked up her undershift from the floor and handed it to her. Clothe yourself, my lady. You will cause no harm tonight. Blackstone and John Jacob stood in the doorway as the Countess clutched the gown about her. As they left her chambers, Kilbert followed them to the bedroom door. He lowered his voice. Your passion does your beauty justice. I have never loved a woman as I have you. For a moment it seemed she was going to answer him, for a smile played on her lips. But then she spat vigorously at him. He grinned. Though I have been with whores who could spit further. And should we have a child, what shall we call him? Get out! She screamed. Kilbert closed the door and turned to face Blackstone and John Jacob. He shrugged. You never know. My offspring might one day rule Felice. The men were back on the walls by dawn the next morning. The respite of even a few hours' sleep had strengthened them. The rain had stopped, but a bitter wind barreled down the valley. As daylight broke and the townspeople ventured out, the wailing sound of grief rose up. Blackstone's fighters had released the town priest from where he had been locked up by the militia before they started their attack the previous night, and Blackstone had ordered him and the bailiff to round up townsmen to begin clearing the bodies from the muddy streets. Handcarts were needed, so Blackstone allowed men to be brought in from the village outside the walls to help. There was little point in Blackstone addressing the townspeople, to tell them that they had brought the carnage upon themselves, and he suspected that word was already making its way to Paris that Thomas Blackstone had invaded and slaughtered the innocents of Felice. "We'll stay here until this storm eases," Blackstone told the captains. "It will get colder. There'll be snow again on the mountains. Keep the fires burning, so that men can stay warm when they come off duty." Perrine limped into the square with Ralph Tate and three of his men. Perrine raised Cade's severed head. "Where do you want this?" "On a pole at the far end of the causeway, so that those who enter the town will see it. Have a notice made that it is William Cade, a routier lackey of King John." Tate turned and told his men to set the pole where Blackstone wanted it. "Do we feed Cade's body to the pigs?" "Throw it in the river. Why poison good pork?" The men grinned as the dead man's opaque eyes gazed up at the man who killed him. Blackstone made his way to the old apothecary's house, doubtful that the young Frenchman would have survived the night. He was admitted by a tired-looking servant who had been charged to keep watch over the injured man. The servant huddled by the kitchen fire as the apothecary greeted Blackstone. Alain's head was propped up by a small cushion, his body covered with a blanket.
"Does he live?"
asked Blackstone.
"The fever broke,"
the apothecary said, and bathed Alain's face with a damp cloth.
"His leg?"
"Another day or more until we know," he said as the young man's eyes opened.
"Until you know what?" said Alain sleepily.
Blackstone grinned and placed a hand on the boy's arm.
"Until we can see whether you're able to ride or not," he lied.
"Sir Thomas," he said weakly, "where am I?"
"We took the town, remember?"
"Oh, yes."
He tried to raise himself.
"My leg?"
Blackstone put an arm beneath his shoulder and lifted him gently.
"It is set and bound. We did all we could do, and the apothecary gave you enough potion to fell an ox. But here you are, stronger than my bastard horse."
He grinned.
"Then I shall soon be able to rejoin you?"
"Soon," Blackstone assured him. "While you slept, we fought William Cade and the townsmen. There's much to tell you, and there's no hurry."
"And Cade?"
"Dead."
"By your hand?"
"Yes."
Alain sighed. "I wish I could have seen it."
"You'll see his head on a pole. Now, I and the men need some rest. I'll have you move to a room in the chateau, where this good man can attend to you when needed."
The answer satisfied the young man, and he lay back down and closed his eyes. The apothecary gave Blackstone a look that told him the young Frenchman was not yet out of danger. As Blackstone stood at the door, he pressed a gold mouton into the old man's hands. His eyes widened, and he shook his head.
"I cannot accept this much," he quietly protested. "You must realize that the boy might still die, and at the very least that he is most likely to lose the leg."
"Keep it. You kept the pain from him, and you will have to buy more medicines. I am grateful for your efforts. I'll send men to have him taken to the chateau." The apothecary bowed his head in gratitude.
"Then I will also prepare ointments for your wounded men. That dried dirt in your hair shows a scalp wound. It should be stitched."
"I'll have my centener attend to it. I'm sure he'll take pleasure in pushing a needle through my scalp."
The door closed behind him. John Jacob had placed men there once dawn had bled into the night sky. By whatever means these things happened, the townspeople would likely know that the young Frenchman was not a monk sent by Prior Albert, but that he was of the men who had slaughtered so many of their kin. Until the lad could be moved to a safer place, then two men would guard the apothecary's house. Blackstone was obliged to step over and around some of the crumpled bodies that littered the narrow street. Women sobbed as they identified their husbands or sons. The town had paid a high price, and the hatred behind their stares as he walked past them stabbed at him like a dagger point. John Jacob dogged his lord's footsteps, walking three paces behind, hand on his sword hilt, watching that the hatred did not boil over into an attack. Blackstone regretted their grief. He too knew what it meant to lose loved ones. Also, these Verlaine's lives were hard, and the lack of a man meant additional poverty and hardship. He raised his face to the wind, and thought he sensed snow in the air. He hoped not. He wanted to escape from Felice in good time and meet up with the Gascon captain, Bayard, who he hoped had gathered more men to ride with them. The fighting here was over, but he had no doubt that a greater conflict awaited them if William Cade had not lied. If it was true, the Dauphin and perhaps the French king had decided to order their army to kill Blackstone should he cross their path, then he would be obliged to try and defend himself. The fact that he had already fought Marshal of the French army, de Audrehem's men-at-arms in a skirmish, meant that King Edward might also abandon him. It would be seen that Blackstone had broken the treaty. His thoughts were interrupted as a woman cried out when she turned over a body. Dirt half covered the face of a boy, probably no older than Blackstone's own son, he realized. The woman cleaved the child to her, pressing him to her chest. The lad's arm had been hacked off, and he would have died from the shock, loss of blood, and the previous night's bitter temperature. Yet it made no difference what finally killed the lad. The woman's son was dead. She bared her teeth at Blackstone, cursed him with such fury as only a grieving mother could, and then began throwing mud at him. John Jacob stepped forward to stop her, but Blackstone held out a restraining hand and let the mud splatter him until the woman's venom abated.
"Remember, John, I know what it means to lose a child to violence."
He wiped the mud from his face and walked on, bringing the silver-wheeled goddess Arianhod to his lips. He would go to the church and light a candle to honour the memory of his murdered wife and daughter, and to give thanks that his son was safe in Florence. Part 3. Brotherhood of the Sword. February 1362. Chapter 52. The Florentine bankers, the Bardi, had wealth, which gave them influence and favour in the court of the English king. But their priest, no matter how hard he prayed, Torellini, could not influence the Almighty. The Marquis de Montferrat, allied with the Pope, friend of Thomas Blackstone, and trusted by Florence, had entertained Torellini and his charge long enough for the snowstorms to blow clear of the mountain passes. The rain that swept the valleys on the far side of the mountains coated the crevices and roots in a blanket of snow. Although these routes were kept open throughout the year, those that travelled from Italy into France, or those who took the pilgrim's way on the journey to Rome, depended on the knowledge of the mountain village guides and their strength and skill in traversing the treacherous passes.
Father Torellini had separated the pilgrim party that had set out from Florence, sending the genuine pilgrims and their knights of the Tau escort further north towards the Brenner Pass, which would take them across the trade route to Lyon, a pilgrimage that would be noticed by the Visconti. And if the Milanese lords had planned Henry Blackstone's assassination, they might already know that the attack in Florence had failed. If that were the case, then this group of pilgrims, escorted by their protectors, would draw their attention. The Marquis de Montferrat had been waiting north of Genoa to take them through the lower passes to Avignon. But even here, where the snow was not as deep as on the higher passes, the weather demanded they stay with Montferrat in one of his castles until a safe route could be determined. Once Montferrat had been made welcome by the fortress's commander, and Torellini had been ushered into the great hall to share wine, a blazing fire, and the promise of safety, Henry had slipped away from his escort and climbed the steps to the walls. Braziers, with half-cupped iron guards on one side of their baskets, shielded the flames from the wind. But the buffeting snow had passed, and a blue sky streaked across the mountain peaks, and scattered its diamond-bright light across the meadow that lay below the castle.
"Boy, you know this place?" said Fra Foresti, when he traced Henry's whereabouts.
He had seen the look on the lad's face when they arrived. For once he did not reprimand his young charge for absconding from his care, realizing that ghosts from the past might haunt the high plateau, and that Blackstone's son might have seen them. Henry Blackstone knew it only too well, knew it and dreaded it the moment they had arrived. His body trembled as he steadied himself and dared to step closer to the parapet in a test of his own courage. His eyes squeezed shut, and then he opened them and gazed down to the ground far below. He knew exactly where the skeletal remains of the killer would be. The air stung tears into his eyes. He wiped them away in case the Tau knight mistakenly thought him weak. He had not realized that the young guardian Hospitaller had moved quietly to his side. He had not heard the crunch of his boots on the snow or the rustle of his cloak.
"Henry," said Fra Foresti quietly.
Henry's gaze stayed fixed on the tree line that edged the snow-covered meadow.
"Before snow comes, there are alpine flowers here. They cover the meadow like coloured snowdrops. There's a lake behind us. Its water is cold enough to snap a man's bones, but men once forded it to rescue my mother, my sister, and me."
He dared a step closer to the edge. "The man who imprisoned us held Agnes and me over the edge. He asked my father which of us should die."
"Your father was here?"
"Down there. He fought three men, and then, you remember John Jacob and Will Longdon?" he asked, turning to his guardian, who nodded in assent.
"They swam the lake, and climbed up the wall with their men and attacked, and saved us. Yes, I know this place. There was a great battle here. The flowers were watered with men's blood. My father's young squire was butchered near here, and the man who killed him was slain by my father in single combat. His body was spread-eagled, and left as a warning."
"There," he said, turning his gaze towards the plateau's edge.
"Somewhere. I can't see it, but it's there."
He looked up at the Tau knight.
"And here," he said, touching his temple. "I see it all. I always do."
"The savage priest,"
said Fra Foresti, suddenly realizing where they were.
"La battaglia nella Valle dei Fiori."
Henry nodded.
"Why would I come to this place again? Why would I be brought here?"
"It is a coincidence, or God's will. You must decide."
Henry remained silent. The memory of the place held him. To revisit it was to be assailed with the fear he had known back then. The thoughts of his dead mother and sister were as haunting as the eerie sound of the wind across the rock face. His hand touched the sword pommel at his belt. It had been his father's squire's sword, given to Henry by his father when its brave young owner was butchered. It had been given to honour Henry's courage.
"Memory can trespass on a man's heart," said Fra Foresti, "but it can also serve to strengthen his resolve. You have walked a stony path over the years, but I see in you a strength that is unique for a boy your age. Those mountains are hidden by the snow, just as you are clothed by a generous spirit. Both disguise an unyielding stubbornness not to be conquered.
Henry shivered, and then did as his father had always taught him, and calmed the urge in his body.
"Let us eat, and find some fireside warmth," said Foresti, "and then we can pray in the chapel. Will you join me?"
The wind hurried the clouds away, exposing alpine peaks that soared into the blue. Henry nodded. He had passed this way once before, and now he would turn his back on the grim fortress that held his memories captive. The guardian mountains beckoned. The moon glowed across the vast snowfields peppered here and there, with a distant glimmer of small mountain villages. The untrammeled crystal carpet glistened as far as the eye could see. Its sweeping curve of downhill contours would lead Niccolò Torellini down into Provence, and then the papal state of Avignon. Henry Blackstone slept wrapped in his blanket, back turned towards the burning logs in his room's fireplace, while below in the great hall the reality of what lay ahead was discussed by the three men who were responsible for his safety.
"Provence has been swept with routiers these past months," said the fortress commander. "This castle guards the way for those who go and fight in Italy. But it is impossible to say what you will find down there. No routier has ever respected a pilgrim."
He gestured away the servant who had poured wine for his lord and his guests. The boy bowed and left them to the warmth of the fireplace.
"And they will not change their murderous ways now," agreed Torellini. "We must pray for good weather, so that we may reach Avignon as quickly as we can."
Niccolò Torellini knew it was because of him that they had only made slow progress along the Via Francigena, and then into the mountains. He was getting old, and his back ached from the horse's gait, and the mountain's dampness caused his bones to grumble. But he made the declaration in such a manner that no one would question his ability to keep up at a faster pace.
"I can go no further," said the Marquis de Montferrat. "Provence belongs to the Queen of Naples, and she would not welcome my presence. And Savoy is on their northern border. If that peacock, Count Amadeus, hears of my incursion, then I and my men would be trapped on the wrong side of the Alps. You will have to go unaccompanied from here."
Torellini nodded. "I knew as much, and did not expect your protection any further, my dear Marquis. I am grateful you shielded us from any attempt by the Visconti to cause us harm."
The grizzled Piedmont lord poured another beaker of wine. "You cannot be certain they are responsible for the attempt on the boy's life. If they were, I believe we would have had a fight on our hands, no matter how carefully we travelled." Fra Foresti considered their ongoing journey. "Count Amadeus of Savoy allowed Blackstone and his son to travel through his territory when they took the French princess to Milan. And perhaps he could be called upon to offer us protection once we reached the lower plains."
"Who's to say he is as benevolent now? A lot can happen in 2 years, and he is still aligned with the Visconti," said Montferrat.
"But he serves the Pope."
"Which goes against their wishes," said Foresti.
"No, no,"
Torellini said, raising his hand to halt any further discussion of who might help them.
"We travel on alone. We are only days away from safety in Avignon. We must look to ourselves. The boy is of value to someone, and we must just pray that his presence is not discovered going into France. He is cursed with his father's name." "But he is blessed with his parents' courage," said Fra Foresti. "He sleeps in a place that held his family captive years ago when he was a boy. His father killed the savage priest here."
At the mention of the murderous killer's name, Torellini crossed himself.
"I had forgotten, of course. I had not given this place any thought."
He tugged the fur collar of his cloak tighter around his neck. It was a draughty castle, despite the fire. The thought flitted through his mind that it might be more than the invasive wind, and there might still be malevolent spirits who clung to the place of death.
A shaft of moonlight beamed down from a high window. Montferrat glanced up at the clear sky. A raw night. The wind will hold, and the snow will fall further north. You should take your chances tomorrow. They left the high citadel as the sun struck its walls. Frau Foresti led the way, his horse going forward, uncertainly, into the knee-deep snow, as they followed the mountain guide. The sharp crunch of the broken surface hung in the still air. Henry followed, and behind him the man who had held his father's near-dead body before the boy was born, and who was determined to see the son safely delivered to his father's side. They stopped at the frozen skeletal remains that still hung, tied with wire, the shield's blazon weather-beaten. The alpine wind and glacial temperature had turned what was left of the man's skin into blackened leather. Henry jumped down from his horse and wiped a gloved hand across the stone slab that rested below the gibbet. The words of warning as to who had killed this vicious murderer and the promise that all men like him would die had been chiselled by his father and would remain long after the savage priest's blackened flesh finally flaked from his bones.
"I saw him die," said Henry, as he climbed back into the saddle, "and I was glad of it."
He smiled at Frau Foresti. He had laid the ghost to rest. Chapter 53 Bayard, the Gascon captain, had travelled as far south as the bridge at Pont-Saint-Esprit, the walled town 20 miles north of Avignon. He had gathered men from disparate groups of routiers with promises of serving a legend of war who would grant them control of conquered towns and districts. That meant profit from patie, protection money, from the towns and villages, enough to keep a band of men in food and comfort year in, year out. The men were mostly Gascons, troops who had served and were still loyal to the Capitale de Bouch. And once these men knew that their lord's captain rode with Blackstone, it made easier their desertion from the coalition of brigand forces that controlled the lower Rhone Valley. Thousands of brigands in bands of varying sizes, some less than 100, others several hundred strong, were scattered across Provence, Ambasse, Languedoc, a shifting mass that nudged the Mediterranean coast and sought refuge in the mountains. If they ever came together, they would amass an army of 5,000 or 6,000. Many of these routiers had tried to fight in Spain, but once the truce had been called between its warring princes, they had drifted back and were already edging their way up the Rhone Valley, wary of being trapped between two French armies that hunted them. Bayard's proposal was not welcomed by all the mercenaries. Many were foot soldiers, unemployed now that the war had been abandoned between France and England. Their ranks swelled by archers and criminals, penurious knights and minor lords who had lost their lands. Their view was that Blackstone did the English king's work, hounding routiers out of towns that had been ceded, which meant he was an enemy of the brigands. Bayard skirted trouble. All he needed was a few hundred men he considered trustworthy enough to fight at Blackstone's side. There were many more who came forward to offer their services but were rejected, their crimes too great for Blackstone to have accepted them. It was already a negotiated part of the agreement with those Bayard had recruited that they would be granted a pardon by Pope Innocent for their part in the destruction and killing that had gone on throughout the south of France. Other mercenaries, who drifted from band to band, sought leaders who would give free rein to their lust for plunder and rape. Such fighters drifted into the mountains, where men of ill repute gathered like-minded followers. The Bretons were recruiting further north after their recent defeat, as were routier commanders like John Armory and John Cresswell, Englishmen who already held garrisons in more than a dozen towns. Others had drifted even further north and found refuge with the Welshman, Griffith ap Madoc. Bayard left his men on the far side of the River Rhone and requested entry through the gates of Avignon. The walls had been reinforced, and there were more soldiers on the battlements, men who had heeded the call from Pope Innocent to help protect the papal city. He would have been denied entry were it not for his service with the Capitale de Bouch and the warrant given to Thomas Blackstone by Sir John Chandos. The document was scrutinised by various guard commanders as he was conducted deeper into the city sanctum, past the luxurious palaces belonging to the cardinals and the bustling streets that thronged with courtiers and tradesmen. Soldiers jostled shoulder to shoulder with bankers and court messengers.
The wealth in Avignon consumed vast supplies of luxury goods. Food was in abundance. Court officials sported fine clothes of silk and velvet. Their cost easily explained as courtiers vied with petitioners in bribing the officials to be heard. Bayard began to yearn for the more simple dishonesty of fighting men, rather than those in this money-grubbing city. He was given a cot and a mattress in a guard commander's quarters, while he waited to be summoned for his petition for clemency and forgiveness, to be heard for those men who would join Thomas Blackstone. He would never be granted an audience with Pope Innocent himself, but he hoped that the liberal use of Thomas Blackstone's name and the Knights' association with King Edward of England would help speed through the suffocating bureaucracy of Avignon. After 3 days he had heard nothing and drifted into a brothel for distraction and pleasure. On the fourth day, as he made his way back to the bleak, dismal rooms that were his quarters, he saw a man approaching through the crowd, and despite the distance between them, he sensed the cloaked figure was making his way towards him. The man had glanced once or twice in his direction and caught his gaze, then turned away, easing his shoulder through the herd of people. Bayard's hand went to the pommel of his sword, but the crowd pressed him, which would make it difficult to draw the blade. He shifted his hand to the knife at his belt. The cloaked figure had ignored him and gone past him, nudging people aside. Bayard scoured the crowd ahead in case the cloaked figure was a decoy to draw his attention away from an assassin or a thief. It was likely there would be men here who harboured ill will towards Thomas Blackstone and those who sided with him, and of course he had mentioned freely that he served the scar-faced Englishman. His attention was held by a rough-looking villein who carried stacked baskets on his back, a rope that bound them together across his forehead. His curt, gruff voice called out for the crowd to make way as he forged through the press, opening up a passage ahead of him, a perfect ploy to suddenly ram a blade between a victim's ribs. The distraction was Bayard's downfall, as a man's iron grip clutched his knife arm, and a whispered warning from the cloaked figure behind him told him to do as he commanded, or the blade that he felt pressing in his lower back would leave him dead on the ground. The knife point nudged him quickly away from the busy street, and Bayard knew the chances of twisting free from it were too slim to risk making the attempt. The man's pace quickened as they went this way and that. Bayard stayed silent, looking for an opportunity to turn and fight, but found none. So determined was his assailant's determined stride along alleys whose narrow walls seemed to have been chosen to make it impossible to resist. Finally, Bayard was pushed into a wider corridor of marble floor and religious frescoes that colour-washed the walls high into ornate ceilings. The courtyard beckoned through soaring arches as the cloaked figure guided him through a gilded door and into a scented garden where a rill trickled water from a gently spurting fountain. For a moment, the contrast between where he had been quartered these past few days and this luxury distracted him. Then, with a firm push in his back, he was shoved further into the sunlight that streamed into the enclosed garden. He turned, ready to fight, but the cloaked figure pulled back the hood of his cloak and stood ready, sword in hand. Bayard would be dead before his blade left its scabbard.
"You use Sir Thomas Blackstone's name with abandon," said the figure.
Another voice came from the far side of the garden.
"And that means you are either a charlatan or are trusted."
Bayard turned. Despite the winter sun's rays that reached into the garden, the old man was dressed in a pale cassock beneath a fur-edged cloak for warmth.
"I am the Gascon Bayard. I serve the Captel de Buch, but I fight with Thomas Blackstone. If there is disagreement between you, then I will stand in Thomas's stead and defend his name. But if you wish to murder me, then be done with it."
The cloaked figure sheathed his sword and stepped in front of Bayard, as the old man beckoned Bayard forward.
"You seek a pardon for fighting men. I can arrange that. This is the house of the Florentine banker Bardi. I am his servant, and God has looked kindly on me, because I cannot go much further. You are the man we are looking for," said Niccolò Torellini.
Chapter 54 After several days, the town of Felice was still mourning the death of those who had served in the militia, and the married men of the garrison troops.
The town was occupied by foreign fighters led by the Englishman, Thomas Blackstone. The curfew was strictly enforced, but church services were permitted. Resentment festered, but no one had dared raise more than their voice against Blackstone's men, who patrolled the walls and streets. The outlying villagers had been brought in with their handcarts to help take the dead to the graveyard. The ground was still hard, but Blackstone allowed the town priest to take as many of the townsmen as he needed to dig graves. Felice's carpenter fashioned 83 crosses, but after the attack, Blackstone refused to pay for them, and instead instructed the Countess's bailiff to recompense the carpenter. Countess Catherine de Valle, still confined to her quarters, was allowed a servant to attend her. "How much longer are we staying?" said Gilbert, as they gazed across the landscape beyond the village roofs. "The weather comes and goes, but we should take advantage of these clear spells."
"I want to be rid of this place. It reeks of treachery and death."
"But Alain is not yet ready to travel," said Blackstone. "There are still a half dozen towns that need to swear allegiance. That will take us into summer, and by then we should decide where to go. We cannot linger because of the lad's wound. We have to leave word for Bayard, so let's take him back to the monastery. We can make a litter for him and leave him in the care of the monks in their infirmary. They won't cause him harm, not now, and we can meet up with Bayard as he makes his way towards us. We could do with his reinforcements."
Blackstone nodded. "I also thought we should do that. If we stay much longer, who knows who will come over those hills? Word will have reached the French king by now, and unless Chandos can be convincing enough, then the French will want us dead. The Countess and William Cade were in their pay."
"It will make no difference," Gilbert said, looking down at Cade's head on its spike outside the main gates. "The French don't need an excuse to come after you, but doing Edward's bidding has shielded us so far, and I'll wager Chandos won't defend us unless he is put into a corner."
"We gave him victory over the Bretons. He won't abandon us. Even so, the French won't need to excuse themselves to him, or Edward, should we be killed.
And this place can be defended, but we would be starved out if they laid siege. And if they bring enough men, then, well, they might throw themselves at us like plague dogs. We've been here too long."
Blackstone knew Gilbert was correct, but he had been holding on, hoping that the young Frenchman would recover from his injury. "Talk to the men, Gilbert. We will leave tomorrow. There's no point in waiting any longer. We will give the Countess back her town."
"You've spoken to her today?"
"No, I avoid her." He glanced at Gilbert. "You've not tried to bed her again, have you?"
Gilbert snorted. "Mother of God, Thomas! I performed heroically that night. I was the old stallion in the herd. I rose magnificently to the occasion. I will be honest and say that I have not known a woman before with such appetite and vigour for the act of coupling. Her knife attack aside, she damn near killed me."
He grinned. "Good to know you raised the flag for England," said Blackstone, smiling back.
"It was a battle standard," said Gilbert.
"Then best you stay clear of her. If she finds you that irresistible, we can't have her following us across France."
As Blackstone went down the steps from the parapet, his shadow, John Jacob, fell in beside him. As they walked up towards the apothecary's house, windows and doors slammed closed. Since they had buried their dead, the townspeople avoided any contact with the man they held responsible. Once they had collected the apothecary, John Jacob took the old man's satchel of medicines, and they slowed their pace to suit him as they walked up to the chateau. Perrine sat in the warmth of the winter sun on the terrace. He got to his feet as Blackstone approached. It was obvious the man's wound was still painful, and he wore his jupon open over the loose linen shirt.
"We need to take a look at your back," said Blackstone. "I don't want anyone unable to ride because of their wounds."
"I'm healing well," said the sturdy man. "No need to fuss over me as if I were a feeble woman."
"All well and good," said John Jacob, "but there's at least one woman in this chateau who would inflict another wound on you for saying it."
Blackstone gestured.
"Let us see it now."
Perrine sighed and tugged free his coat and shirt, then bent his back muscles so that the ugly welt could be examined. The searing hot iron had blistered the skin, and when his muscles were flexed, The gash looked ready to split. The apothecary ran his fingers down each edge of the wound. He nodded to himself, and then bent to open his satchel.
"Keep the wound dressed,"
he handed Perrine a small Hessian sack of herbs.
"Can you make a poultice?"
Perrine dropped his shirt and nodded.
"This is comfrey," said the apothecary. "Let the poultice cool, and then cover the wound. Bind it with fresh linen every day for as long as the herbs last."
He turned to Blackstone.
"He must not be put to physical work, or raise a sword in anger, until the time comes. If the wound splits..."
He shrugged. Who knew what might happen? Perrine looked from the old healer to Blackstone.
"Do as he says," said Blackstone, and placed a hand on the apothecary's shoulder. "Now the youngster."
They went past Tate and his hobelars, who guarded the kitchen and main door into the chateau, and on into the lower rooms. In one with a south-facing window, which allowed the sunlight to stream in, Alain lay covered with a fur-lined cloak, with two blankets on top. The boy shivered despite the warmth from the fire. Tate sat with him, keeping a moist flannel on the boy's forehead.
"Has he slept and eaten today?" said Blackstone. "I got some broth down him a few hours back, but he is neither awake nor asleep. The fever came on him a few hours ago," said the nursemaid Hobelar. "Master Apothecary gave me ground fennel liquid for his fever. I dribbled some into him, but the fever has not reduced, my lord."
Blackstone acknowledged Tate, who then shuffled past the three men to wait outside. John Jacob pulled back the bedclothes, and he and Blackstone wrinkled their nose at the smell. The apothecary lifted the long linen shirt to above the young Frenchman's knee. The leg was swollen. Pus and crusted skin gathered along the stitched wound. Angry red fingers clawed up Alain's leg into his thigh. The wound had festered. The apothecary lifted the lad's shirt higher. Blotches, some as big as the palm of a man's hand, had formed and peeled on the skin of his stomach and thigh. Pustules clung to the bare flesh. John Jacob crossed himself.
"I thought we had held back the poison, Sir Thomas, but it's gone from his wound into his blood. For these past days I have bled him, but I have no cure for this."
"If we take off his leg, will that stop the poison spreading?" said Blackstone.
"Now there is no choice, Sir Thomas. It is his only chance."
"John, fetch the butcher."
Perrine watched the shadow circle high in the sky. The buzzard was mocked by high-flying crows, but the raptor ignored their determined attempts to chase it away. It lingered, soaring higher, gazing down, waiting for the next man to die. They carried the young Frenchman into the brightness and warmth of the winter sun. Blackstone summoned Ralph Tate to fetch Will Longdon, whose wound-stitching skills would be needed, and then had his men who guarded the chateau's door carry the heavy kitchen table outside. Some of the townspeople gathered in the courtyard below, where only nights earlier other blood had been spilled. As three or four people at a time stopped to observe what was about to happen, John Jacob hurried the butcher before him. He wore a belt of pockets that held his cutting and paring knives, and clasped a saw and a cleaver in his fist. This was the second time he had been summoned to the ailing Frenchman, and once again he was sweating more from fear than the rush through the streets. Moulin strode alongside them, carrying a small pail and an earthenware jar.
"This is better than hot pitch. Clay and turpentine will seal the stump. I took these from the carpenter and the potter," he said, placing his cargo to hand near the supine body.
"And this seals the wound and stops the poison?" asked the apothecary.
"We don't know. We have seen barber surgeons on the battlefield use it. They soak the wound with turpentine to keep the flesh from rotting, and then pack it with clay."
"Very well," said the old man. "I am no surgeon. All I can offer is to try and subdue his pain."
"Few men can stand this agony," said Blackstone. "Whatever you administer, make it a draught that will keep him asleep throughout."
The apothecary hesitated.
"There is only one mixture of herbs I can give him now. I have a preparation of 3 parts black henbane, one of ground poppy seeds, and one of hemlock. If he survives, he will remain unconscious for 3 days, perhaps more. The potion itself is dangerous.
Get it, said Blackstone. He'll die anyway.